I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Brigadier G.R. Bradbrook, M.C., and the date is 22nd of May, 1980.
All right. Came to Canada in 15. So,
No, at age 15.
At age 15.
Yes, right.
Although I had been in Canada for a couple of years before the war broke out, I was really an Englishman. And it was under those circumstances that I got a letter from my father telling me that a war had broken out and that for my family credit, I must join the army or the armed forces. Well, that wasn't very easy because I was such a puny little runt that nobody would have me. I made several attempts, I remember, in Moose Jaw and Winnipeg, and finally I was happened to be working in the bank in Portage la Prairie, and one of the customers was a Major Williams. I always remember him, he was killed later on. He was a major in the militia, the 18s Mounted Rifles, and he had orders to raise a company, I imagine it was. So I went to him and volunteered to go as anything at all, and he took me on as a trumpeter in the 18s Mounted Rifles. I subsequently found myself as a bugler in the 32nd Battalion Infantry stationed in Winnipeg. Well, I wasn't much of a success as a bugler because all the wind came out of the sides of my mouth instead of going into the bugle. So I became a private. And they didn't fire me out of the 32nd Battalion, and I finally found myself overseas at Shorncliffe in England.
What sort of training did you experience in Canada before you got overseas?
We drilled at the exhibition grounds in Winnipeg. We lived in exhibition ground buildings, which I remember were very flimsy and very drafty, and nowadays you wouldn't I don't think you'd let animals live in them, but however, we had palliasses and blankets. And we lived about three platoons to a room or shed with hardly any ventilation and a great big pot-bellied stove in the middle.
Well, would you like to explain the composition of a palliasse?
A palliasse is a linen bag in which you stuff straw, and that becomes a mattress.
Right.
Well, however, then we did a lot of drill on the inside the racetrack, and of course most of the first months of drill was marching about and treading down the snow, so that it was smooth enough to march on. It was a bit slippery then.
This was 1914, and
which was in 1914. And we spent Christmas there.
Yes. And uniforms, you had a full uniform, a kit of some sort?
We went down there in red tunics and blue breeches and brown leather leggings and one thing and another, but we finally were equipped with khaki uniforms. And we had khaki uniforms in time for Christmas, and I remember a big Christmas dinner under the grandstand was the mess hall, and we did training, which was mostly marching about and doing platoon drill and things like that. Nothing much else.
You had your rifles at this point?
I think we had Ross rifles, but being a bugler, I didn't carry one.
Ah, yes. You were still a bugler at that point in the 30s.
Yes, so I still carried the bugle, although I couldn't blow the damn thing.
If you'll just hang on a minute, we'll just...
Well, I was sick quite a while, and I spent some time in hospital. Eventually, the unit got orders to go overseas. I think it was about February. And we boarded a train and we went down to Halifax. And we got on the ship called the Vaderland, a Belgian ship. And I was seasick all the way over. And we finally landed, I think, at Avonmouth near Bristol. And we took a train and we finally landed at Folkestone. Then we marched all the way from Folkestone to Shorncliffe. And one of my memories was passing a fried fish shop in Cheriton on the way to the Risborough Barracks. And I can always remember the smell of fried fish and chips on the way to New Barracks and my reintroduction to England, fried fish and chips. However, we trained at Shorncliffe for a while, and then the battalion, to its great disappointment, was split up and sent as reinforcements to the various depleted units after the Battle of Festubert. I, of course, was left behind because I wasn't big enough or fit enough to go. Then I spent time in hospital, and then they put me in the orderly room. And then I got the job in the orderly room of the Canadian Machine Gun School, which was then at Shorncliffe. I remember Major Banfield was the commander, the commandant, and I was his sort of secretary, I wouldn't say stenographer, but I could use a typewriter, so I was a typist. And all I did was pound a typewriter for about 6 months at that machine gun school. And one of the instructors there was writing a book about machine gunnery, and I had to type it all out. And I learned quite a lot about machine gunnery from that book. I then thought that I still would like to go to the war, so I kept on parading to Major Banfield asking to go, and he wouldn't let me go. And finally, in desperation, the adjutant was on leave and I lived at the machine gun depot, which made up the drafts for overseas. And I bribed the orderly room corporal, who was with whom I shared the barrack room, and I gave him half a crown, and he said yes, he'd put me on the next draft to go to France.
That's lovely.
And he put me on the draft with six other people, and we went specially as machine gunners to the 28th Battalion.
Now, at this point, you were a textbook machine gunner. Had you ever fired one?
Yes, I had actually taken a course on the Vickers machine gun. Mm-hmm. I can't quite remember how I managed to wangle it, but I did. And the Vickers machine gun was not in use by the Canadian Army then. They used the Colt machine gun.
Oh yes,
gun.
The Colt, yes.
But they were going to eventually adopt the Vickers, I think. However, that only belonged to the machine gun companies, not the battalion.
Yeah.
So I went to the 28th Battalion as a machine gunner, and I found myself on the brickfields at Albert, after a long march, and they said, all right, well, you bed, and they showed me a piece of ground, the six of us, And we built a bivvy out of our ground sheets, and we dosed down. There was no buildings, no nothing.
You were in fact joined this battalion without any real battle training at all?
No battle training at all. I've never even fired a Lee Enfield rifle. Oh.
Well, was this this was common at that time. They hadn't produced sort of battle schools or advanced infantry training
establishments. No, they hadn't really.
Mm-hmm. And was the Lee Enfield in general use by that time?
Yes, the Ross rifle had by this time been discarded, and we were issued with Lee Enfield rifles at the depot at Havre before we went up the line.
Yes.
So.
Which you had never fired?
No, I'd never fired.
No. Okay.
So then we practiced a little bit over the tapes, and General Turner, who was our divisional commander of the 2nd Division, said that they had some queer new things which could go along and go over shell holes and knock over trees and ride right over the top of machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they were going to use them.
And this would have been, 1916?
This was 1916, yes. At the Somme.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we then, on the 15th of September, the 14th of September, we went up the line, and early in the morning of the 15th of September, we went over the top. And I remember going over the top and laden down with so much stuff that I would be unable to do anything even if I had to bear it anybody. And there I saw these queer looking things which turned out to be the tanks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we saw these tanks lumbering around, and half of them broke down, of course. And then I finally arrived over behind the creeping barrage. I arrived over at what was supposed to be our objective, and I looked up towards the right, and I saw a German officer behind a breastwork with his Luger pistol, and he was shooting quite a lot of people, and he killed my company commander. I can remember mm-hmm. seeing my company commander get killed. So I rested my rifle on the edge of a shell hole, and I took careful aim, and I shot this German officer. At least, anyway, I fired my rifle and he dropped.
Yes, well, will we pause here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so now we're back.
Well, we spent 2 or 3 days in the trenches, and I remember the bombardment, the German bombardment was pretty terrifying, but somehow or other I wasn't as frightened as I expected to be. And anyway, we finally came out, and I remember we got to the cook wagon, and I produced my mess tin, and he piled on a huge amount of bacon. And the reason he was able to pile on such a lot was that we'd gone in about 600 strong, and when we came out and we all lined up with the left out of battles and everybody that was left, it was only a good sized company. So I don't know how many we lost, but anyway, they could afford to give me a tremendous amount of bacon for breakfast.
It might have been 150 or so men there, or 200 at most, I suppose.
Oh, probably 300 or 400.
Oh, that many there?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if I may go back a little bit, you mentioned that when you went over the top, you were laden down with all this equipment. Was this partly just because it was a thing that was done, or because you had to live when you got there, if you got there and survived?
No, I think it was in those days. I don't think the authorities were very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that I had my overcoat, and as it was September,
I decided it was easier to wear it than to carry it. I didn't have full pack, you had your battle dress on, you know. But in my overcoat pocket, I had a Mills bomb in both pockets, each pocket. I had two extra bandoliers of ammunition round my neck, and they had to be hung round my neck with a necklace because my gas mask had to be in the alert position.
It was in high on your chest.
Safety pins. Yeah. It's one of those flannelette bags that you pull over your
old
head.
Old type with a
couple
of eye holes.
That's
it.
Very old type. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I had a pickaxe that I had to carry.
Good grief. Yeah.
And so here was I staggering over the top with all this weight.
That's where you had a water bottle and you had rations.
Iron rations and. Water bottle and 250 rounds of ammunition.
And a bayonet and
Rainier equipment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my rifle and my pickaxe. So
you must have been carrying 50, 60 pounds, were you? 50 pounds?
More than that. More than that.
Good heavens. You couldn't run very far.
I couldn't run.
Or run at all.
Anyway, we went behind the barrage, which in those days the barrage moved at 100 yards. A minute, and
that's pretty fast for you.
Well, later on, that turned out that was too fast, and I think when they had a creeping barrage, it was 200 yards to the minute or something like that.
No,
I mean, 200 yards.
No, well, that's faster.
Oh yeah, that's faster. Yeah, well, whatever it was, very hard to
distance. Ah, I see. Yeah,
But even at that, I was in the third wave, and of course I had a lot of people in the first and second wave, they got knocked down. So at one time, I found myself so close to the barrage that in those days they used shrapnel, and it burst over your head, and then a whole cartload of shrapnel bullets went ahead of you. And I decided that I was pretty close to this barrage, so I'd better sit in the shell hole for a few minutes, and which I did, and then it lifted, so then I went on. Even though it was only 100 yards to the minute, I caught up to it.
Oh, yeah. Hmm.
However, this is all rather hazy recollection, but I can remember those silly details.
Oh, you had taken these German trenches then when you were...
We then finally arrived at the German trenches, and it was after spending 2 or 3 days there, as I say, we were relieved, mm-hmm. and we went back. Mm-hmm. And that was when I had all the bacon and one thing and another.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, then we were in rest for a while, 2 or 3 days, and then we went back into the line. And I can remember an extraordinary thing then. We were in some trenches, and our corporal was named Corporal Downton. He cannot remember that all those years back. And he got word that he had to go in and guide in a couple of other battalions of the same brigade. So he said, well, you come with me. So we went along a row of trees and shell pot ground, and I can't remember. We finally arrived on the outskirts of Corselette. And we waited, and finally the battalions turned up, one at a time. And Corporal Downton says, well, now, Bradbrook, you guide this battalion in, and then I will follow on with the other one. Now, can you believe it? Here was I, a 19-year-old recruit, who had been in the line once before, didn't know anything at all, and here was I guiding in a battalion of Canadian infantry into the line, and I hadn't really a very clear idea of to where I was guiding them.
Not extraordinary.
However, I had a good sense of direction, and I guided them back to where we'd been in some trenches on the left of a huge gravel pit, a chalk pit or something of the sort. So I guided the whole battalion in, told them to take cover, get up close to the wall of this gravel pit, which they did, and then I looked around and tried to find an officer, and I found the, which I think was the commanding officer, and then I took him along the road in Corselet, right in Corselet by now, and to where I thought battalion headquarters was. I took him along. I remember there was a bent railway line over this pathway, so I took him along underneath the bent rail and took him along to battalion headquarters, and there I left him, and then I went back and back underneath the bent rail and went back to the trench on the left of the gravel pit where I had originally came from. And eventually I think Corporal Downton turned up with the other battalion. And I can't remember much what happened after that.
But you were successful anyway, at least in getting them
there. Yeah, I got them there without any casualties.
Yeah, yeah.
Well then, the next day we were moved along under the bent rail. And we went along, and then we moved forward, went into some trenches in advance of Corselet. And then, while we were there, they decided to have a bit of an attack. And the tank was sent for, and the tank came along, and it got stuck, and right in no man's land, and I don't know how the inhabitants got out of it, but anyway, the attack was called off.
They used sort of individual tanks or small...
This is one tank.
Small probes and that.
That's all it was.
They did, yes.
They sent for a tank, and a tank came, and it broke down. So then apparently they decided they were going to bomb out the Germans. Anyway, the two trenches, front line, were joined together with an old German communication trench.
Oh, yes.
So I was detailed as a bombing party to bomb down this trench and get to the Germans that way. Well, it appears that it was about then that the Germans decided to evacuate that position and make a big retirement from the Somme. And although we did some bombing, I didn't throw any bombs and I didn't do anything, except we finally got to the end, and then we ran across the road where there was joined some trenches on the other side of the road where there were some British soldiers, and we greeted them and they shook hands, good old Canadians, and it was...
Why were you not employed at your trade, if you will, your machine guns?
I don't know, it never occurred to them to...
Did they not have...
They didn't have any Vickers guns, and they had enough Colt machine gunners there, I suppose.
What was it, about four to the battalion or something along that?
Something like that,
Not many, yeah.
Well, I'll be coming to that in a minute.
Right.
We were in the trenches there for some time with, and the Germans had apparently retreated for miles. And so then we were withdrawn, and we came out, and we were out for another couple of days, and then we went back in. Now we sent back in again, and that this time I was sent in with the Lewis gun section. I was supposed to know about Lewis guns.
Had you ever seen one?
I've seen one, yeah. But I didn't know anything about them. And anyway, I went in with the Lewis gun section, and that's the worst trip that you could possibly imagine. We marched all night for 12 solid hours in the dark and the mud and the slippery, and finally arrived in what I think was Regina Trench.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was it was just absolute desolation, and we did, some of our people carried little Red Cross flags and went out and got wounded in, and we could see Germans doing the same thing. There was no possible chance of them attacking us, and there was no possible chance of us attacking them. It, the mud, and it was indescribable. So we were there for about 3 days, and then up came the 43rd Battalion, I think, in kilts. And I remember one fella arrived, and he sat down on a hummock with mud, and he said to me, he said, "Well, we've come up to relieve you, I suppose." He said, "I'm not afraid, I'm not frightened." He said, "I'm absolutely, completely, and totally all in. And there's nothing I could do about it or do for anybody."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I'm completely finished."
Just bushed, absolutely. Eh?
That's all he was. Then, however, we then got out. And
Perhaps you might give us say a little about what were the living conditions in the trench? Well, how in this particular kind of landscape full of mud and water and so on, how did you live in dugouts, or what did you do?
There weren't dugouts. You couldn't dig dugouts. Yeah. Just mud, and that's all there was to it. I remember getting time to have a sleep and lying down and saying how nice it was. I didn't have to dig a hole to put my hip in. The mud was nice and soft. I could do like.
You were soaking wet most of the time then?
Oh yes.
But there was no real shelter at all?
No. And you got tin rations, and I can remember on this particular occasion, I got a piece of bread, and I got it all covered in jam, and a shell burst, and all the mud went up in the air and came down on my bread and jam.
I can imagine your language wasn't too choice.
Well, I was right away, you see.
Yeah.
And then another thing was, I had a gunmetal cigarette case. And I took that out to get myself a cigarette, and a shell burst, and a little bit of shell came along, hit my cigarette case, and sent all the cigarettes flying in the mud. I don't know whether I still have the cigarette case. I don't know whether I did pick up the piece of shell, because it was sizzling in the mud. It was hot,
Yeah.
Anyway, it cooled down. I did pick it up, put it in my pocket with a cigarette. I don't know whether I still have it or not.
Jolly good you didn't have a bare hand out there for some reason.
No.
Yeah.
Anyway, then we came out, and then we went, we marched along, and it took us out of the Somme, and we went in somewhere near Vimy, I think.
In the Somme, to go back there for a moment, was there a fair number of casualties from illness, disease, or trench foot, or anything like that?
I suppose there was. Of course, I got the flu right after I came out of the Somme, mm-hmm. but I didn't get it while I was in the Somme.
There. No,
I've suffered from rheumatism all my life, but I never suffered from rheumatism after.
Oh really? Not after that?
No, never after that.
For heaven's sake.
And but there was a lot of sickness and one thing or another. But
did they make any effort to provide you with sort of wet weather gear, rubber boots,
a ground jacket? Not at the Somme, they didn't.
Uh-huh.
Only in the set-piece trenches. But then they had rubber boots, which were sort of trench stores. You took them over from the next person that relieved you.
Well, I think I read somewhere where they issued a certain number of rubber boots, a very small quantity compared to the number of men involved.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you had to use them and you pass them on.
That's it.
Yeah.
They were trench stores.
Yeah.
Like barrack stores.
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah.
So, that was after we left the Somme. We went into a place like that, where we had rubber boots and trench stores and so forth. So it was.
I suppose the flu must have been a nice rest in a way. Yeah.
Oh yes, it was in a way, but I stupidly enough, I was. I can't explain it to you now, but I was so young that I was full of patriotism. I couldn't get back to the unit fast enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And although being in these big battles scared the life out of me, I always looked forward to the next one.
Did you?
For some reason or other.
Yeah.
I guess I was young and super patriotic, so that's all I could think of.
I think, one has to have pretty high morale in order to put up with those sort of conditions.
Yes, yeah.
And...